Okay, good morning. Last time we talked about the Gaonim and why they didn't write a Perush on the Gemara. It's not a consistent Perush on the Gemara. We have cases, many cases, where people would write to Baghdad and would ask for interpretations of specific sugyas, but not more than that. And apparently there were political and educational reasons, as I mentioned, not to do so. There is, in fact, I mentioned it in passing, there is a fundamental difference between the Babylonian, Sephardic, if you want to call it, perception on rabbinic authority and that which is true of Ashkenazim. In general, again, you can find exceptions wherever you go, but in general, the tradition of Babel and Spain is a tradition of centralized authority. That you see that in the claim of sort of an almost outrageous claim of the Gaonim that that they're instead of the Yeshivas are instead of the Sanhedrin and the Gaon is instead of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is it's a little bit over the top, but the general idea is that there's one source of Torah and so on. This, by the way, led to something of a world war between the Babylonian Gaonim and the Gaon of the Yeshiva of Eretz Yisrael, which wandered through the Galil, even into the Golan. There's a lintel, a door lintel that they found in the Golan. I think it was in Katsurin, but I'm not sure. Which was stood over the entrance. Thank you very much. Entrance to the Beit Midrash of the Yeshiva of Eretz Yisrael in the Golan, which is in the Jerusalem. You can see it. Occasionally they bring it out. Last time they brought it out was on the occasion of marking, you don't really celebrate these things, but marking the 900th anniversary of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael by the Crusaders. But there was a really ongoing battle between Eretz Yisrael and Babel as to which really is the center of Torah, and it got to be somewhat, what should we say? I would say nasty. Rabbis really don't get nasty with each other. Right? But it got to be very intense. Let's call it that way. Let's do it that way. In any event, but in any case, the Sephardic position is the Sephardic Babylonian position tends to be more centralized. That is probably not unrelated to the fact. It's not something we're going to talk about today. If you want, and some of the shiurim I gave last year about difference in Ashkenazim and Sephardim, you'll find that the Babylonian-Sephardic, approach to halakhic truth is that there is one truth, and if you make a mistake, you can either be right or you can be wrong. So therefore, when the Gemara says in Erevin, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, that means that basically we don't have a Sanhedrin, we don't have an institution which can determine halakhic truth. So as a result, we have to do the best we can. But ultimately, as far as heaven is concerned, something is either right or something is wrong. Period. Ashkenazim have a totally different take on things. For our purposes, the best way of explaining it is a medrash which is cited by the Ritva in the name of the Rabotenu at Sorfatim, French rabbis. We know the use of this medrash goes all the way back to at least the early 12th century. I suspect it's even earlier. Medrash Tillim says that Moshe Rabbeinu went up to heaven and he saw that. To get the Torah, and he saw that there was a machlokas in Yeshiva Shalmala between God and the angels, and everybody's got 49 ways, if they're arguing for, they're arguing this way and that way, and each one has the same number of proofs either way. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, I came up to get some direction over here. So he says, Rabbeinu Shalom, this can't, how's it supposed to work? If everybody's right, you know, you're right, you're right, you're right. You know the joke? You do know the joke. You're right. It can't function that way. So the Medrash has God saying to Moshe Rabbeinu, whatever you say will be fine. Whatever the Chachamim Shem Chol Dovr Do will say, that'll be fine. However, the idea being that there are multiple opinions already in heaven. So as a result, things are much more diffuse. And this difference in diffusion and centralization is something which marks the difference in Psak between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. It's not for nothing, for example, it's not a coincidence that Rav Avadya Yosef's Epitaph Livracha actually wanted everybody to accept the one ruling of Rav Yosef Karo. He knew he was going to get that, wasn't going to get very far with the Ashkenazim, but so at least, you know, all the Sephardim should accept one way, because Torah has one, you know, it's either A or not A. In any event, so the idea that ultimately control of information and authority and parshanot should be found among the Gaonim is not all that, it fits very well with this general tendency among in Masoret Bavel and later on in among in Spain to a lesser degree, as we'll see. Now, after the period of the Gaonim, for all kinds of reasons, ends with the death of Rav Hai Gaon in the year 1038.
What
did you want? I'm
sorry? Excuse me. What did you get your coat?
What's my coat?
What did you say?
I wanted a Coke. Coke! So I didn't know you didn't know where the machine was.
So I'm taking someone's coat recorded. And I didn't get you a Coke.
No, no. Same. So I have a Coke. Fine.
Back to why you're talking.
In any event, after 1038, it's remarkable. You have a shift. You begin to get a shift of Torah activity from the east, west into the west, and at precisely the same time, you have the beginnings of independent parshanut of the Gemara. Two of the earlier efforts, they precede Rashi actually, both take place not in Spain but in North Africa, which is quite the same island. In the city of Kairouan. Kairouan is a city in the shores of North Africa. At the time, it was the largest and most important Arab or Muslim city in North Africa, major trade center and so on. Two individuals who lived there. One of them is Rav Nissim Gaon. He was a goyin, but he wasn't a gaon. In other words, he was not formally a member of the yeshivot, but he was certainly a genius. He lived in Kairouan between 990 and 1057. Simultaneously with him is writing Rabbeinu Hananel ben Chushiel. Also in Kairouan, he lived 965 to 1055. So they really overlap exactly. Rabbeinu Hananel's family, interestingly, came from Bari in southern Italy. His father, Rabbeinu Chushiel, emigrated to Kairouan. He is one of the famous four captives that we know the story from a man in the late 12th century whose name was Abraham ibn Daoud, who wrote a book called Sefer Kabbalah, which means a book of tradition. Mysticism is called Kabbalah in order for us to think it's part of the tradition, but the word Kabbalah per se means tradition. That's where the Rambam talks about things, Salomdim, Midivrei Kabbalah. The Rambam was not a Kabbalist, no matter what anybody tells you. He didn't study Kabbalah, he didn't study mysticism, despite the fact that there were a later reformation who tried to sort of co-opt him for the mystical camp, it's a stretch. When the Rambam says Kabbalah, he means Ishmi Pishmi Pomoshe Rabbeinu, as Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. In any event, the two of them live in Kairouan, and they both leave us Perushim. We don't have all of their Perushim, to a large degree because Rashi basically swept the field afterwards. But what I want to show you just for a sec is to see exactly, give you examples of how they write, to see what they were about, and then we'll contrast them to Rashi. But it is very interesting that exactly at the exact same time, in two very different Jewish cultural orbits, you have the beginning of independent parshanot separate from the Gaonim. Let's start with Rav Nissim Gaon. Rav Nissim Gaon wrote a number of books in which he lays out commentaries. I've picked easy examples because we don't have a lot of time to go into long, intricate discussions. Mishnah and Brachas. Mishnah says in Brachas, Maskirin Yetziat Mitzrayim Ba'alelot, you should recognize this from what? No? From Pesach. This Mishnah appears at a prominent place in the beginning of the Haggadah, before everybody goes to sleep. Maskirin Yetziat Mitzrayim Ba'alelot is a mitzvah of Schirat Yetziat Mitzrayim at night. Okay, as opposed to during the day, that everybody agrees. Amar Rav Elazar ben Azariah, Harei Ani Kiven Shivim Shana, I'm almost 70 years old, Velo Zachiti, I never was able to convince anybody, Shetayamer Yetziat Mitzrayim Ba'alelot. I couldn't convince anybody there was a separate mitzvah of Schirat Yetziat Mitzrayim at night, until Ben Zoma interpreted it, and he said, L'man tizkor yomet seicha meretz Yisrael kol yamei chayecha, yamei chayecha yamim, kol yamei chayecha alelot. Adkan. The rabbis say, no, there's no mitzvah, it's a raya, there's no mitzvah. But in any event, Reb Elazar ben Azariah says, I'm almost 70 years old. The Gemara is going to understand that he was as if he felt like he was 70 years old, if he was only 18. That's what the Gemara says later in Brachas. In any event, that's the story. Rav Nissim Gaon, on this Mishnah, knows what he says. Zeh Shashaninu, Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azarya, Harei ani kiven shivim shana, Mifrisha milte beperik tfilat ha-shachar. We learn about it becomes interpreted, it becomes clearer or is played out later on in the Masechta, in perik tfilat ha-shachar. Why does it just tell you the perik? Because the book wasn't printed yet. There weren't dafim, there weren't amudim. All you knew was sometimes later in the Middle Ages you'll find, or not necessarily even in the earlier Middle Ages, you'll find they'll say towards the beginning, towards the end, in the middle. But that's the best you can do. There's no unified pagination. And obviously the guy put down daf kavchet, is just adapting the pagination we have. By the way, when was the pagination? Who first paginated the Gemara the way we have it? It was a Christian named Daniel Bomberg in the late 15th, early 16th century, published the first full Shas. Had a lot of Jews and Mishumadim working for him. Apparently, he got a license. He was one of the biggest printers of Jewish books in the world. There are indications he wanted to publish Hebrew books, not just to make money, but because he thought that if he did that, he'd get he'd gain credibility and be able to publish missionary tracts and attract Jews to Christianity, but that's another story. In any event, he says we learn the details of this story of this Kiven Shuvishana later on in Masech the Tfilas Hashachar. B'masa shahaya ben Rabban Gamliel Rabbi Yeshua be'et yiskimu chachamim la'avir Rabban Gamliel migdulato. When there was the great revolt against Rabban Gamliel, who was a very overbearing Nasi of the Sanhedrin, and he getting embarrassed and humiliated Rabbi Yeshua the third time, so they deposed him and they wanted to put up Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to be his replacement. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah had yichus because it was a benachar to Ezra Sofer, and also he had tons of money. So he gave Torah, Gdula, v'yichus, b'akom echad, just like Rabban Gamliel. Now, says the Gemara of Almar, and the Gemara there says, v'ha bar tamnei srei ana. I'm only 18 years old when this happened. He tells his wife, I'm only 18 years old. How can I take this job? V'let l'chivarta. And I don't have any white hair. Irchishle Nisa, our gear says it's Rachishle Nisa, that a miracle had happened to him. Vahadule Tamnesre Dare Chivarta. He got 18 lines of white hair in his beard and his hair, so he could look old. Vahainu Ditnan, and that's why the Mishnah says, Hareiniki Venture Yimshana. I'm not really 70 years old, I just feel like it. I don't know about rabbis, but you can, they say, it's really actually true. If you take a look at the way presidents of the United States look when they go into office for the first time, and they look, and you see how they look 8 years later or 4 years later, they're always white. They've aged enormously. It's really incredible. Not for nothing that Chazal say how Rabbi Mekaberet et Baalea, the rabbin, no, that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about public service, but anyway. In any event, notice what, that's all he says on this mission. So what does Rabbi Nissim Gaon do? He basically paraphrases the Mishnah, gives you all you need to know for one point, sums up what's there in a self-contained paragraph, and that's it. Okay? So there is a general, so as one of the scholars, the late Professor Yisrael Tashma, was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, was a Muslim over Herzog, he was a star in Hebron, points out that what Rav Nissim Gaon does, largely, is to provide supplementary information about the sugya, to paraphrase the sugya and to make an independent entity that you can read without relation to the Gemara. As you're learning Gemara, but these little essays you could read. I could read this without the Gemara, not a problem. Okay, it's self-contained. Something similar happens in the case of Rabbeinu Chanana. Rabbeinu Chanana, who again lived in Cairo between 965 and 1055, so he died about 15 when Rashi was 15, or 14, depending on how you do it. On the you find something similar, or actually even more dramatic. He says over here in this is Rabbeinu Chananel's comment on the Mishnah Megillah Daf Yud Tesamid Beis, where the Gemara talks about who can actually read the Megillah. Masnitin hakolk sherem lekroes a Megillah chutz micherishot v'katan. Rabbi Yehuda Mashi v'katan mantana cheresh. He gives you the whole Gemara, and then he sits there and summarizes the Shaklu V'Tarya. So again, it's like monarch. No, I don't know. You guys probably don't know what monarch notes are. Monarch Notes or Cliff Notes are these little books they used to give out when I was in high school and college that summarize the books you're supposed to read, and they tell you all the questions that they're going to ask on the test and what are the major issues and criticism, stuff like that. You can read the Cliff Notes, and you don't have to read the book. When you're talking about something like War and Peace, it can be a very big one. You lose the joy of reading. But in any case, Rabbi Chananel is a self-contained little essay on the topic related to in the Gemara. Now, Rabbi Chananel does more than that on other occasions. He very frequently quotes the Talmud Yerushalmi. In fact, he's one of the first Rishon to extensively compare and contrast the Yerushalmi and bring the Yerushalmi into halachic discourse. Whether that's related to the fact he came from Italy and Italy had early relations with Eretz Israel is another story. But in general, again, largely you can read Rabbeinu Chananel without the Gemara. It's like notes on the Gemara. He brings in other discussions, little self-contained essays, topical essays in general. Occasionally he will sum up what the issue is at point in a specific Gemara, not do more than that. There are different patterns. But in general, what is true of Rav Nissim Gaon and Rabbeinu Chananel is they both generally paraphrase and summarize and supplement. And that's it. Okay. That is not... why do they do that? So the reason is probably that, or very likely, put it this way, I don't want to expose myself to withering criticism. But it is probably true that they do this because they're assuming that the person who is using their commentary knows how to learn already and is under the tutelage of someone else who's going to provide him with the general, method of how to approach things and will guide them through their learning. So all they provide is extra stuff. Summaries or extra material or extra sources to consider nikuda. And occasionally, Rabbi Chananel especially, he'll try to provide the nub of the halachic discourse. What's the machlokas about? What specific point of departure? And not infrequently as well, he'll give you what his opinion is as far as the psak is concerned. But again, it's supplementary information. You still need to be part of an organized learning group to be able to function. And you see that what they're doing is basically outside of the study of the text per se, which lines up it's of a piece with what we saw among the Gaonim. When we get to Rashi, when we come to Ashkenaz, when we move north, it's a whole nother ballgame. Before we talk about Rashi and where he came from and what he does, I'd like to tell you a little about his life it's important, or it's interesting anyway. Rashi was born around the year 1040, maybe 1041. He was born in the town of Troyes. Troyes is a town east-northeast of Paris. It's not that far by car. It's about an hour by car. It's longer if you're going by donkey or by the horse. No, you laugh. When I was a kid, growing up, I grew up on stories of my great-great-grandparents moved to Israel in 1882 as part of the Aliyah Rishonah, and my grandmother went to school, actually, in Yerushalayim, and high school still exists, Evelina de Rothschild. We grew up on stories about how it took 3 days to get from Yafo to Jerusalem. And I was wondering, where they sleep. So a friend of mine told me that he knew from his grandfather, who was named Mayor Bar Ilan, was the son of the Netziv, after whom the university is named, that there were three inns that people would stop at. They would leave on the old Yerushalayim Tel Aviv Road. They would stop in Ramlin. There was an inn you would stay at. And then if you ever go up to Shar HaGai, there's a gas station on one side, a Paz station, a yellow Paz station, as you're driving up to the hills. On the other side was now a bird observatory, but that was the remains of another inn where they would stay. And underneath the overpass near Bevaseret, buried in the overpass is the remains of a inn they would stay the third day, the Khan. And then the fourth day they would arrive in the third day. One, two, three. On the fourth day they would arrive in Jerusalem. So something similar over here. So it's far. And here you can drive to Tel Aviv in an hour, and so you'll be able to take the train in 35 minutes. Anyways, it's about an hour's drive outside of Paris. It's a town that had a Jewish community and had a learned population at least in the early, middle part of the 11th century. It grew into a learning environment, or at least basic learning environment. We know that the rabbis in Troyes, or the population, the community in Troyes, was in touch with the gedolim of the of Mainz and of Worms. Those were the two Rhenish cities, which were the centers of Torah scholarship at the time. We know nothing about his father. His father Yitzchak is not the Rabbi Yitzchak Patach at the beginning of the Torah. That's actually taken in race. That passage, the beginning of the passage, is taken out of the Midrash Tanchuma, where they quoted somebody else named Rabbi Yitzchak. His mother, we don't know. We only have one Perush that his father offered. His mother was something of a Miucheset. Her brother was a major rabbinic figure in Mainz. But Rashi apparently by the time he was 18 or so had more or less exhausted the learning possibilities in Troyes. Although there were those who say he was already quite accomplished by the time he left. At 18, he was already married with at least two kids. Rashi only had daughters. The one was Miriam, one was Yocheved. Then there's a question of the two others. We're not sure. One was possibly being Belaset, which is a French name. Possibly Rachel. There's a whole discussion of whether he had two or four daughters. The two daughters, the older daughters, Miriam and Yocheved, were better known because they married major rabbinic figures. Yocheved married a man whose name was Meir ben Shmuel, who was the father of Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashbam. And the other daughter, Miriam, married Rabbi Yudah ben Natan, who was also a major parshan and worked with his father-in-law in things. When he was, but in any case, by the time his father apparently died, and that's what some say, but certainly he was already a householder with a wife and children that he had to support, but he decided Chashka Nafshi B'Torah, so he upped and went to move to Mainz, and to study in Mainz and to Worms, which was where you need to go to learn. Rashi knew in advance he was going to be able to be there forever. He was apparently back and forth any number of times during his 10 years that he was studying in Mainz to run the family business. We'll come back to that in a minute. Or his own business. During the time he was there, he did manage to study with the leading authorities of Mainz and of Worms. Most interestingly is his first Rebbe, the one he thought was the most influential for him, was Rev Yaakov ben Yakar, where Rashi on more than one occasion says that he not only learned information and comments from Rev Yaakov ben Yakar, but he learned methodology, which allows, it seems like, you know, it's like, give a man a fish, he eats for a day, teach a man to fish, he eats for a lifetime. So the same thing over here. It's one thing to be spoon-fed information, you have whatever information you have. If you learn how to think, then you can actually function on your own. So Rabbi Yaakov ben Yakar, it's clear that he learned methodology. And during the 10 years he was in Mainz and in Worms, he worked overtime to acquire the maximum amount of the traditions of Talmudic interpretation of what are called Perushei Mainz or Perushei Rabbeinu Gershom or Agolah, which I will come back to. In 1070, finally, he moved home, and he sets himself down between 1070 and 1105, 35 years, unless he started this earlier while he was in Germany already, to undertake his two major masterpieces. One is the Perush on Tanakh, and the other was the Perush on the Gemara. It's interesting. One of the there's a scholar who suggested that Rashi must have been born in 1030, not in 1040. So the answer why? Because it's not possible that somebody could have pulled off both the Perush on Tanakh and the Perush on the Gemara, and only to have lived to the age of 65. That's very nice, but there are people who are phenomenal. The Rambam, for example, did something similar in his... Rambam also lived to be, 65 or 60? I don't know. Hold on. He lived to be 60, right? He was born in 1135, 1138, depending on what you want to do. And he died in 1200... Yeah, lived to about 65. And what he did was also equally impossible. You can't fathom it. You can't fathom it. When you read Rambam's Perush on perish on the Mishnah, which he finished in the, at the end of the 1130s, when he was, oh, I'm sorry, 1160s, rather, at the end of the 1160s, and you realize that this person had had worked out all of his halachic and philosophical positions by the time he was in his late 30s. And as a result, he had mastered everything there was that lay behind that. It's like you just jaw dropping. There were just some people that are jaw dropping, brilliant. You know. So the Rashi could have done all this in 65 years. It's possible. It's not such a stretch. It is certainly possible. In any event, Rashi was very into poetry. He wrote all kinds of piyutim and stuff. But then he was also a public figure, which makes it even more remarkable, like the Rambam, who was also a public figure and managed to create so much. And he died in 1105. Okay, that's basically Rashi's biography. We could talk about Rashi for the next 6 weeks, but I'm gonna do something terrible and just sort of try to highlight what it was that what did he accomplish, how did he work, and what did his commentary lead to. In order to understand that, what we need is to see where he was coming from. Rashi went to Mainz and Worms in order to be able to study in the yeshivot that were established by Rabbeinu Gershom Mor HaGaula and his students. What Rabbeinu Gershom started was the parish that goes under his name, which is increasingly being published from manuscripts and so on. What Rabbeinu Gershom started was a cumulative parish on the Gemara. Basically, first of all, they studied all of Shas. Well, that's very important to mention. They studied all of Shas. In Spain, they didn't study all of Shas. One of the fundamental differences in Ashkenazim and Sephardim is, again, that there was a very, I don't call it utilitarian, but there was a very strong emphasis in Spain on those areas of Shas, of halacha that are halacha lamaisa. Those siddarim which are not halacha lamaisa were understudied. Cite me a proof. Give me an example. The riff in general. Look at the riff. What did the riff do? The riff is also living exactly the same time. He's the exact contemporary of Rashi. I forgot to check it up. I think he died in 1101. Okay, exact contemporary of Rashi, lives in North Africa, then moves to Lusain into Spain towards the end of his life. What does he do? He does two things. First of all, he abridges the Gemara. On every single sugya that is halacha lemaisa, he'll give you the maskanos, he'll give you supplementary information from the Geonim, he'll tell you major he'll give you the clincher in terms of the argument and give you the psak. That's number one. Number two, he only covers those parts of Shas that are halacha lemaisa, which means that he takes those parts of chul that he discusses are only the parts that deal with kashrus. In terms of Taurus and Shpacha, he doesn't have a discussion of Nida. He takes those parts of Masepta Nida, which are not most of them Masepta, by the way, and deals with them, but he moves them into his discussions in Masechet Shvuos, which have some discussions of Tuma related to Beis HaMikdash, but so he tacks it on over there. The idea is you don't do Kutchim, you don't do Zroyim, you don't do Taurus unless it's halacha lemaisa, Nikuda. And that was this utilitarian, pragmatist kind of attitude was very common in Spain. I don't believe this. Didn't go on. Wow. Okay, we'll just have to not put it up this way. Among the Sephardim, you have this attitude. You only learn halacha lemaisa, whereas in Germany they studied everything. They literally studied everything, at least all of Shas. What was going on with Tara with Taurus and Zrayim is another story. But at least those areas where they had the Bavli, there was no discrimination whatsoever. That's number one. But what would happen? We saw last week the passage from the the passage from the Orz Zeruah, the sort of freewheeling kind of atmosphere that took place in the Beis Medrash. We looked at a discussion about whether what comes first, Tchiyas Shavuot or Mila. But what generally went on was that Rabbi Nav Gershom Margolo or his students would offer an interpretation of the Gemara. They would go through a sugya. The Rebbe would interpret it. One of the students would write it down, and then other people were encouraged to add. And these collections, recordings of the ongoing discussions of in which variant and multiple answers were offered to the interpretation of sugyas going through Shas. This cumulative effort ultimately became known as Perushei Magensa, the commentaries of Mainz, and something similar happened in Vormaisa with variations, which maybe we'll talk about next week. Okay, so what you have here, therefore, if you look at it, this one says this, the Yesh Omrim and Rebbe says this, to the point where we don't really know what Rabbeinu Gershom said, because generally the interpretations on Shas are mentioned anonymously, so it's very hard to know who says what. But again, it's a source book for discussion. It's sort of like the kind of crib notes that you give out after a course, which depend upon your having been in the course and having a teacher. There was a sort of yeshiva-centric kind of attitude toward this thing, because otherwise you wouldn't know how to make hide nor hair of what's what. You following? So as a result, it was a flowing commentary throughout Shas, but it was reserved for those people who were in the yeshiva. But again, they did cover all of Shas. Rashi comes back from Germany in 1070, loaded with various unofficial transcripts of the traditions, the various interpretive traditions of the yeshiva. Of the yeshivot which he studied. And he sets himself down to writing a perush on the entire Shas. Okay. In this regard, later on, he had help from his son-in-law, reviewed him in Natan, he has help from his grandson, Rashbam, but by and large, he did it himself. What he achieved is mind-numbing. So the question is, what does Rashi do? I mean, well, let's take a look. What does he provide? Why does the Gemara need to be interpreted in the first place? So first of all, if you take a look, if you know Aramaic, but you need Aramaic, which means that ultimately Rashi's Perush, nobody's Perush, is good until you basically have sort of an elementary school education in Hebrew and basic Aramaic. Otherwise, you can't function. But if you know Aramaic and you read through a sugya, you could understand the words. You could understand the words, just as if you were to take down the Sansino translation of the Talmud, because Schottenstein and others are not, and the Steinsaltz already have Rashi put into the inside the text. You could take down the Schottenstein and you could understand the words. You know, what's missing? Number one, it's punctuation. You don't know when's a question. You don't know when's a statement. You don't know when. Sometimes what looks like a question is actually a citing a proof. Something says Vahatanya. Usually that means there's a brisa that disagrees with what you're saying. But sometimes Hatanya means, as Rashi says, Benichuta, that say you know what? It's not just but there's a brisa. It's not but you know there's a brisa. Whether it's but you know or whether you know. It's all the difference in the world whether it's a kasher or a teres. I've seen more than one person who sat there saying, "Hatanya," but this says the same thing, and they say, "No, Rashi says it's supposed to be bringing a proof text." So there's no punctuation. You need punctuation. Number two, you need background information. You need background information to tell you if this is a subsidiary discussion. Where is the major discussion? You need certain information to know who the people were. You need background material. You need to know, and you also need to be fended off to say, don't go off in the wrong direction. This is what this is talking about as opposed to something else. Sometimes all of this can be achieved with one word. Sometimes all of this can be achieved with just a couple of sentences, but it keeps you on mark. That Rashi, by providing, we'll see there's more than that, more to it than that, by providing both of those, made the Gemara accessible. Right? That's number one. Number two, and this is a chiddush, is something which, again, Professor Tashma notes, and it's really, you don't think about it this way. Rashi was the one who, if he didn't originate it, he certainly made it into a what's the word? He made it into a shita. I mean, he systematized the systematized things. He used extensively the technique of the Dibur HaMatchil. What's the Dibur HaMatchil? What's the Dibur HaMatchil? If you look in Rashi, what's the Dibur HaMatchil? Oh, look at Rashi, Dibur HaMatchil X. What's that mean? What did I just ask you? Right. Not more than what it's called. To what words is he referring? Rashi does not paraphrase. Okay? When you paraphrase, it's like reading the Meir. You can take the mirror, you can read, you can take it to bed and read it, not a problem, and you know, and I don't know how long you stay awake, but you know, you can read it, you don't need the Gemara in front of you to read the mirror. Yeah, it's paraphrastic, it's very nice, okay? If I were to give you just Rashi, okay, you would be able to function. Because Rashi casts the parish in such a way that you are constantly attached and not enslaved, you say Meshua Bad in Hebrew, but you are constantly in connection with the Gemara. It's a parish which requires that you never take your eyes off of the Talmud. Because what he does is he fills in between the lines. He fills in the punctuation, he fills in the background information, but if you don't know the text itself, you know what he's talking about. Okay? That's the reason why the Schottenstein people what's it called? Rabbi Art Scroll. Rabbi Art Scroll and also all the knockoffs that come out to compete with Art Scroll. Basically, 95% of the time, 90% of the time, just take Rashi and stick it between the words to fill out the thing, because that's what Rashi does. By the way, there were Sofrim in the Middle Ages who thought they were doing everybody a favor. They just stuck Rashi in the text. You can find Gemaras where manuscripts of the Talmud where they just stuck Rashi in between, so that it reads slowly. But the problem is not everybody agrees with Rashi. It's sort of like makes it difficult. But in any event, so he makes the text accessible by providing everything required, and he did it with such skill that it was really remarkable. So the first thing is he created a parish that was text dependent that provides all of the background information and all of the punctuation in order to make the Gemara understandable and to provide what you need. Take a look, for example. Since we're learning Ketubot this year, I thought I'd take a couple of examples from Ketubot. Just the first, the first Rashi's on the Mishnah. Betulan is said liyom arvi, valmanal liyom hachamishi, ushepamim mayim b'shabbat batei dinim yoshvim b'ayarot, b'yom hashini b'yom hamishi, shema yalotanat betulim haya mashkim lebeitin. Okay? Yafeh. Rashi jumps in and says, takanat hachamim hi. First of all, you know, it's not a din d'oraisa, it's a din d'rabbana. Shetinasei b'rivi b'shabbat, kidi b'faresh taima. And what's the reason? It's the very reason it's mentioned in the Mishnah, because you want it, because it might be a person of a Tanat to Tulim, you go to Bezdin. Point is, don't for anything else. This is the reason. Shepamayim b'Shabbat, abetulakai. Because Pamayim b'Shabbat, that sentence is unclear. Does it refer to an almana too? Only to a betula? Rashi says, no. This is not, don't ask yourself, why would I worry about an almana? There's no Tanat betulim by an almana, at least not manisuin. So Rashi says, immediately, don't worry about that. In other words, he's not only telling you information, he's telling you where not to go. We don't think about it, we just mumble it up. This is a very careful, Rashi is being a guide here. All right? Let's go further. B'sheniu v'chamishi. So now Rashi tells you why it's on month Tuesday and Wednesday. Monday and Thursday, rather. Interestingly, he tells you stuff that's found in another Masechta. Achat Maaser Takanot Shitikein Ezra B'Babakama Perek Meruba. Why is it only Perek Meruba? Is that because there's no pagination? Meferesh Lekulu. If you go over there, you'll find all the answers. Why each one was enacted. V'lachach Tiknu Shitinase Birvii Shemayala Otanat B'Tulim Yashkim LeBeitin Bod Kaso Alav Im Yesh Shehut Beintai Im Yesh Lachush Shema Yitpayes V'Titkarer Da'ato V'Kaimena V'Shema Hizin Tatachta V'Nesra Alav Ki Delfinan B'Sota B'Nistro V'Nitma Mitok Sheyavo LeBeitin Yitbarer Davar Ki Sheyitzea Kol Shema Yavo Eidim V'Gemar Parav V'Titinase Be'Echad B'Shabbat. Okay? So he tells you the whole background.
why and how and what's the issue and what am I afraid of. So now I can go into the Gemara fully armed without having to go run to go find the Gemara in Baba Kama. Truth of the matter is, this is my own speculation, it's possible the guy didn't have a Gemara in Baba Kama. There were mistakes. You're talking about Masechtas that are floating all over the place. Not everybody has a full Shas. So he's giving you what you need for right now on this Masechta to know this. But you should know there's more to do this. If you ever see a Baba Kama, you should know that too. We'll see in a minute, well, not maybe not today, but next week. We'll see that, in fact, there were whole Masechtas that people didn't have. There is a real reason to think that the Masechta Avodah Zarah, which is probably one of the most important Masechtas in the period, when it, because they're living for the first time in a Jews are living in a dominantly Christian environment, and how to get along with Goyim as a minority. Some rabbis didn't have. So Rashi is giving you everything you need from Sota, from Baba Kama, so you can function here. Okay? There's more than that, by the way. There's more than that. There's, the truth of the matter is that Rashi here also, excuse me, is implicitly, first of all, he also says, I know you'll say, if the courts are already sitting on Sunday, Monday and the Thursday, so why dafka have a virgin get married on Wednesday? Let her get married Sunday. If you're worried about the next day, he has to go to court in case it turns out she's not a virgin. So he says, don't worry. Hang loose. It's okay. It's a good question, but we'll find out later. Sometimes you have to suspend judgment. So Rashi, by the way, also is already anticipating what the Gemara is going to say, and he already knows what you're going to think. Okay? Again, we mumble. This is very thought out, didactic stuff. Rashi, and in addition, I'll add one more piece, which we'll come back to, and that is that Rashi, one, there's another aspect to not looking at other Masechtas. Rashi is very, very focused on the subject matter under consideration right now. He is sugya specific. Yes, he's very much aware. He's learned all of Shas. He's very much aware that there are parallel sugyas where the same issue comes up and so on and so forth. Overwhelmingly, Rashi concentrates on the dynamic and the implications of the words here. He does relatively little compare and contrast. As opposed to, or in contrast to who? The Balei HaTosfos, his grandchildren and their students, who that's what they do for a living, is compare and contrasting. Rashi is very, very sugya specific. And you have to keep that in mind when it comes to finding contradictions, apparent contradictions, between Rashi dealing with similar issues in similar masechtas, the specificity of what a sugya says. I'll give you an example from something just came up yesterday in the discussion. Last Wednesday when I was here. The Gemara says, you'll recall, on Daf Hei Amud Aleph and Ksuvos, that that the building of the Beis HaMikdash is a Maaseh Tzadikim. It's something that Tzadikim do. It's because it's greater than the act. And by contrast to the acts of God, God does it with one hand, and Tzadikim do it with two hands, as if it was a greater achievement. However, Rashi in Sukkah says that the Beis HaMikdash is not going to be built by men. The third Beis HaMikdash is going to be built by, it's going to come down from heaven. So which is it? Happens to me, I think Rashi thinks the second says that the third temple is going to come down from heaven. But if you, without deciding that discussion, it's very clear. The obvious meaning of the sugya in Ksubis is that the Beis HaMikdash is built by people because it's explicit. The Gemara explicitly says it's a Maaseh Tzadikim. What Rashi comes to the idea that the Beis HaMikdash is going to come down from heaven because of the specific dynamic of a discussion in the Gemara and Sukkah about how could the Beis HaMikdash be built in such a way so that it would be built before the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach when you have to bring the Omer. It's got to do with the Takana of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai as to when you can eat chodesh or not. But the point is that the dynamic of each sukkah is different, leading to different interpretations by Rashi. Rashi is sukkah specific. Okay. So we said that it's text dependent, punctuation, he gives us background material, and he's sukkah specific. By jumping in here also, we can also elicit something else. You know, no, let's wait for the next one. I want to take a look at another example. Rashi's comments are also multi-layered. Okay? They're multi-layered, and that's important. Rashi, we're going to skip down to number 3 for a minute. Rashi writes this commentary in such a way that it's good for beginners. Basic beginners can't understand Rashi either. You need to have a make a certain introduction to the world of learning. Once you're an advanced beginner, you can already learn Rashi, and Rashi is a crutch, and Rashi gets you through it, and so on. But part of Rashi's genius as an educator is the fact he also writes in such a way as to provide hints of the deeper meaning and implications of his words for a person who's an advanced student. Okay? Rashi never tells us what his approach is, what his opinion is, and what a specific machlokus is about. He does it by making a fact, by making interpretation, from which you deduce Rashi's shita. Right? As you look at Rashi, Rashi says so and so. So by reading between the lines, by looking behind the words of Rashi says, what are the implicit assumptions of Rashi in this kind of case? That's his shita, that's his approach. Okay? That's something which a beginning student won't catch, but which an advanced student will catch. And Rashi codes that in, so that Rashi is there for the advanced student, as well as for the beginning student. In addition, there's a lot of discussion, much of it justified, that often by looking what Rashi does say, you can actually figure out what possible interpretations he doesn't give you. He sort of implicitly rejects others. That's called shmira. I said it this way because I didn't want to say it that way. And there were those who have argued if you learn Gemara Rashi and you sit there thinking logically, you can actually work out all of the alternatives in the Rishonim. Because at the end of the day, there's only X number of logical alternatives in a specific sugya. Which brings us to another thing. Rashi, as opposed to the Perushim of Rabbeinu Gershom, of so-called Rabbeinu Gershom, of Perushim Magensa, which is cumulative with many, many different options in every single position, on every single sugya, Rashi gives you one line of interpretation. It's unified, it's integrated, he decides between the various approaches, and gives it to you. Occasionally, more than occasionally, he will say, that's true, I say X, and my teachers say Y. And I'm going to tell you, sometimes he just gives you another alternative, but sometimes he says, and I'll tell you why you disagree with my teachers. And when you see those disagreements, it's remarkable, because in those times when he says, Rabotai Pershu, or Rabotai Pershu, and then he says Y, he'll say things like, Libi Megamgam, I don't know, I'm not sure. Rashi is incredibly deferential to his students, to his teachers, rather. Now that doesn't mean that Rashi gives in. We'll see in a case in a few minutes, perhaps, where Rashi actually didn't give in. But it's always out of tremendous anava. Rashi's modesty is amazing. In fact, on the contrary, the one word or the two words that you almost never hear Rashi say are Ani Omer. Okay, unless he comes to tell you what Lo. Yadati Perusho. Then he'll tell you. But generally he hides behind the words. He lets the ideas speak for themselves. He never talks about, he very rarely talks out of turn, except for cases where he really felt there was a tremendous need. In any event, let's take a look at number 3, as an example of where Rashi codes in, sometimes codes in cross references for the advanced student, which the beginning student wouldn't get, but the advanced student picks up immediately. Gemara in Kiddushin Daf Ayin Gimel Amud Beis. That's a nun that should be there. Ne'eman bal mekach lomar laze macharti vezele lo macharti. Two guys come and they want to buy X, and there's only one X left. So they both throw the money at him, and the seller is allowed to say, "I sold it to him, not to him, and here's your money back." The other guy. If he's still holding the thing in his hand, so then he can say. But if not, he's not believed any longer. Fine. Just want to jump down to the last Rashi. Okay, we don't need to do the rest of them. Okay. Aval bizmanche in mekho biyado, Ushnehem ochazimbo, eino ne'aman. Dekeva, in other words, what happened over here? They both throw the money, they both grabbed it at the same time, and they're fighting who has it. At that point, he doesn't have a right to say to whom he sold it. Dekeva de lavale rami, because it's no longer in his power. Tulo daiklus kord lemihu, it's not in his power, it's not, he doesn't care anymore, it's, he got the money, he has no ne'amanus. Take a look at the first two words of that Rashi. Shnayim ochzimbo. What does that remind you of? First Mishnah in Bab Metzia, yeah? And where, and what's in the first sugi in Bab Metzia? This Gemara in Kiddushin. Rashi is here giving you an internal cross-reference. You know what? If you really want to understand this din, you've got to this is one of the cases where Rashi does compare it to stress. So you got to go over there because the other discussion is there. It will supplement our understanding here. Now, if I were just a beginner and the Rebbe decided, I'm 10 years old, I'm going to start learning Kiddushin, I don't know if it's the best idea or not, but I'm going to start learning Kiddushin so that I won't pick it up. Okay? But if you're an advanced person, oh, you know what? That's right. It's over there. Shnayim Ochzin, here's a little bing, 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 bing. That's what you have to do. So Rashi says it's multi-levered, multi-leveled, very supple kind of formulation Rashi does. And he does it a couple of words. Rashi is also well known, especially for his sparsity of language. Rashi talks a lot. I mean, I remember the Rav used to say, what's Rashi talking so much? I mean, Rashi generally is really right on. So it's interesting. In this regard, when you compare, again, I wasn't, it's not a seminar, so I didn't thought it was relevant. When you compare those Masechtas that we still have, the Perushei Magensa, to Rashi, it's very clear that in 90% of the cases, Rashi reworks and arranges and decides and works upon the basis of the Perushim that he got from his Rebbeim and Magensa and Vormaisa. Maybe 10 to 15% is his totally original. But he transforms it. His genius as a Parshan, his ability to be able to choose the most cogent line of interpretation and his ability to present it is what made all the difference. And as a result, and one of the things which is really striking, here we're going to go over to number 5. Okay? And what's striking is the fact that the evenness of his perush as well. There were mesechtes that Rashi had an entire tradition of how to interpret that he reworked and cast into his own idiom and did as I've mentioned. There were mesechtes where Rashi started from scratch because he had nothing. And sometimes it was the most difficult mesechtes that was with regard to that. Right? For Chaim Soloveitchik, mentions in one place. He says it's one of the places where Rashi comes out like the Rambam. The Rambam in parts of the Mishnah Torah was working on the Gaonim. There's a whole tradition about and the stuff, the Nezikin and stuff, where we had a long hundreds of years of Psak and Perushim and stuff, and the Rambam recast it and in his own inimitable way and wrote the Mishnah Torah. But there were areas where nobody had studied any of this stuff since the time of Chazal. And the Rambam had to take everything together, pull it all together, make Seder, and decide and interpret stuff that nobody talked about, as in Zroyim. The Bavlam didn't learn Zroyim, so he had to start with the Yerushalmi and to make order. The thing is that you would never know it. In other words, you would never know from the quality of the presentation and from the evenness of the formulation that there's any difference between the material that the Rambam had when he wrote Sefer Zroyim or what he did Sefer Nezikin. It's all the same. Same thing with Rashi. Rashi and Bava Metzia and Bava Kama and Chulin had kiflayim of material that he got, that was he inherited, that he recast, and he adapted it in his own way. And there were whole mesechtes that he started from scratch, or virtual scratch. Take a look at number. We'll close with this. We'll finish Rashi next. We'll finish with Rashi next time. Can we go a few minutes into? Okay. So this is a Gemara in Mishnah Chul. It's a famous Mishnah Chul. If you ever learn for Smicha, this will give you nightmares. Sugiv Tipas Cholov. Tipar Chalav, said the Mishnah. In Chul and Daf Kufchet Amud Aleph. Matnitin. Tipar Chalav, shenafla lachaticha. Im yesh ba menos ein tam ba osa chasicha osa. Nierak deira, im yesh b'nosin tam, b'osek deira oser. If a drop of milk falls on a piece of meat, if there is enough milk in order to be able to impart a taste of the milk in that piece, then then something is oser. We paskin that it's the chasicha becomes oser. Then the whole question is whether the whole chasicha becomes mevela or not, and if he falls into the kadera, whether you need chishim, then it's the chasicha against the tipa. Well, that's another issue. If you mish the whole thing together, so if the chasicha is no sin tam the kadera, then the whole thing kadera is oser. Yes, sir. All right? Now, that's the way Rashi interprets here. Now take a look at the tshuva at the Rashi at the bottom. This is the last tshuva in Tshuva's Rashi. There's no such thing as Tshuva's Rashi. Rashi's tshuvas were never organized. They were preserved in dozens of manuscripts, different places, in the Mordechai, in the Or Zeruah, and in different other manuscripts like Montefiore 98. But they were organized by a conservative rabbi in Pittsburgh whose name was Israel Elfenbein. In any event, this is a very famous tshuva. Rashi says as follows: Halev yodea, my heart knows. Your heart knows. Terad amatzoi ba'agura. I'm so busy with harvesting the from the grapes. Okay, let's say yachrieni aduni rabbi arzet kotzer midli. I'm so busy with the grape harvest, so that I really have no time to write except briefly to you, Rabbi Ezra. You know very well how busy I am. Based on this comment, that's where the idea came that Rashi was a winemaker. Professor Soloveitchik has argued, I think persuasively, Rashi was probably not a winemaker. He probably was busy. He's probably busy just harvesting the grapes to make his own wine at home, because based on the way wine was made, there was very little possibility of involving a non-Jewish labor. It was expensive. And people made their own wine for the whole year, and since they didn't have soda, didn't have coffee, didn't have tea, all they had was water or beer, wine was not just for shul, wine was also what you made, what you drank all year long, by the way. And it was also an expensive commodity. How do I know? Prove it to me. Prove to me from the davening that wine is an expensive commodity. No. No. I know what you guys do after half-time. You probably go to Kiddush Club. What? Avraham, Misha Berach. Yivrech Kol Kachek, Al-Kadosh is there. Misha Noten Yayin Aner Lama'or, V'yayin L'Kiddush L'Avdola. That's, hello, you're going to donate. That's what you bring for dinner when you invite it to somebody on Shabbos night. You go and you'll pay 25 shekel because the Yardane is on sale, and that's it. What? Beseder, that's also? You provide a meal for the Orchid?
Bread's also an expensive
food. A pot, I think, really means more than that, a meal. And also, but yayin is expensive. Candles are also expensive. They're labor intensive, you're going like this. You ever go to Old Bethpage? Oh, yeah, you're not Americans. You ever go to places where they show how they used to make candles in the middle? And they just take a stick and you take a wick and you stay like a golem for 24 years. That's a very, it's a very, it's a, candles are expensive businesses. And in fact, the traditional donation, when people would come to town, people who lived in Yishuvim where there weren't shuls, they'd come to town for a Shon Yom Kippur, for the Chagim, and whatever. And inevitably, especially if they came for Yom Kippur, invariably the donation that they would bring to donate to the shul was candles. And in the Middle Ages, the poskim, the tshuvas are full of discussions. What am I going to do with 3 billion candles? Am I allowed to? No, the discussion is Mishanim Tzaka Litzaka. They donated these candles to the shul. Do I have to? Do the candles have to be restricted only to use by the shul? Can the shul sell them to pay for other things? Which tells you that this was considered to be, I mean, if you came to make a day, you had an aliyah, and they said, how much are you going to give to the shul? They say, I'll give you a box of candles. They'll look at you like you're crazy. But in the Middle Ages, that was a serious business. In any event. So anyways, Rashi was apparently just making his own wine for his own purposes. In any case, so he says as follows. So he says, Mi'idani alei shamayim va'aretz. I call heaven and earth to my witness. Shekibalti mi Rabbeinu Yitzchak Halevi. B'shchitat chulin, that I heard a tradition from my teacher Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi, who was in Vormaisa, in Worms, in the Masechta of Shchitas Chulin, right? B'chol makom sheshaninu ba iser baser b'chalav b'nosein tam. Everywhere it says in baser b'chalav, that the chalav is oser b'nosein tam, but not b'mashehu. Understand what the words mean, right? Okay. Hayar ragil lomar li lo gamrin in mahamasechta. We don't accept that. V'lo avdina kavasei. You don't follow the din, the Gemara in Chulin. The hastama masnitni. There's a Mishnah in Avodah Zarah. The basa b'chalav b'mashu. That basa b'chalav when the chalav falls on the chaticha or anything basa b'chalav falls on the chaticha, they asur b'mashu. No, it's just that it's there. That's what that means. Ditnan elu asur v'isuran b'kolshu. Okay, and there it says b'mashu. Umitara harali basar b'chalav b'mashu. And as a result, he paskin for me. You have to asur basa b'chalav b'mashu. Vanilo natati libi azli lachor advarim. I didn't check it out at the time when I was living in Vermeisa. Vahala rabbeinu lo ayashone masechta vodazara. My teacher never learned of vodazara, and there are indications he didn't have a vodazara. Although not to learn it, and not to know it well, or not to have it, is the same difference. If you don't understand it, then what is it? Ukshebati lechana, when I came to France, I got a copy of Vodazara, and I started learning it. I understand. It's not possible. His pshat is wrong, which is secondhand anyways. And it's not possible. I disagree. That the Basa B'chalav is the same time. We paskin like the Gemara Chulin. When I came back to visit, 5 years later, to Varmaisa to visit, Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi, he says, I laid out my reasons to him. Which means what? Respectfully, he what? He argued. He was willing to, he was willing to say, he stood up for his own positions. But the point is, what do you derive from this? Number one, Rashi was his own man. Number two, there were places where he actually was a total pioneer, not just a partial pioneer. And number three, this is a perfect example of where he was willing to go head to head with his teachers in order to, because he was convinced that he was right. But he did it in the most agreeable and most modest fashion possible. We will finish this up next week and go on to talk about Balei Tosfos. Yes?
Just one question that I've always wondered about Rashi.